Hi, this is Jeannie Patel-Thompson from ListenToYourGut.com. I specialize in natural healing for digestive diseases. And today we are very fortunate to be talking to Dr. Michael Ruscio. Now, Dr. Michael Ruscio is a functional medicine doctor, a researcher, and an author. His own healing journey began when, in spite of being a lifelong athlete, he found himself tired, depressed, hair thinning, low libido, brain fog, and with gut problems. Now, once he learned that gut infection was the root of all of his problems and he healed that, balanced his hormones, and got his health and life back, Dr. Ruscio is therefore the ideal person to speak with us about this issue of which tests for IBD or IBS are actually necessary. So if you've been diagnosed with Crohn's, colitis, diverticulitis, or irritable bowel syndrome, and you're wondering which of the, you know, many tests that you can spend your money on will actually make a difference to your course of treatment, and which are, you know, interesting information but pretty much a waste of money, Dr. Ruscio is the ideal person to guide us on this, not just because he walks this path with hundreds of his own patients, but because he's been through this process himself. So at any point, do know that you can get a hold of Michael at drruscio.com. That's drruscio.com. So, Michael, thank you so much for joining us to speak about this important topic today.
Hi, Jeannie. Thank you so much for having me.
And so let's just, why don't you tell me, start by telling me you get someone into your clinic. And I know you specialize in SIBO, which is small intestine bacterial overgrowth, but you must see the whole gamut of people with IBD and IBS. Would that be correct?
I do. And there's also the important point to mention, which is that there can be this overlap between the two. There can be cases of IBD that may be flaring because of small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. And that's important for people to be aware of because they do have different treatments, right? Of course, inflammatory bowel disease is typically treated with more of an anti-inflammatory type of intervention, whereas bacterial overgrowths are typically treated with a more antimicrobial type of intervention. So sometimes just having a clinician who's looking at these things a little bit more broadly could help save someone from floundering with many different anti-inflammatory interventions when it's actually an antibacterial intervention that may get them to a point of remission.
So are you saying that when you have a patient come in, you're not so much interested in their diagnostic label, but you're more interested in their actual symptoms and what they're experiencing?
Well, yes and no. I mean, we want to look at really the whole clinical picture. And I think you ask a good question that reminds me of something I think is important for the audience to be aware of. But I guess in short, in answer to your question, it's not just about the labs. It's not just about the diagnosis. It's not just about the symptoms. It's using all these together to try to make the best decision for the patient. But regarding testing, there is something I think is very important for the consumer to be aware of, which is information is really a type of marketing, right? And so whether it be with a new lab or a new treatment or a new supplement, you know, one of the most powerful ways to market these things is with information. And what this can end up doing is flooding the Internet with all different types of information. And these things, as you said earlier, they sound really attractive and really appealing, but oftentimes these things are more speculative than they are really tried and true clinically viable interventions. And I think that's just important. I just want to make that prefacing comment because it can be easy to get sucked into this lab value as if this new lab value may hold the key to someone's successful treatment. But if we don't have an established treatment for that lab value, then that's just really academic information that doesn't really have a lot of bearing. So in direct answer to your question, we look at practical lab tests in conjunction with someone's pre-existing diagnosis if they have one. And then the other piece of this whole picture is looking at someone's symptoms and looking at how their symptoms respond to II treatment. And all these things together are really used to guide the patient to feeling better as quickly and as efficiently as possible.
Right. So now would we be able to, would you be able to quantify, say, let's say someone comes in, and how far can we break it down? Like, can I say to you, okay, Michael, you've got someone with Crohn's, colitis, diverticulitis. Which tests are you ordering for them? And you've got someone with irritable bowel syndrome. Which tests are you ordering from them? Can you break it down in that way, or is it still more person-specific than that?
No, I think there's definitely ability to kind of partition these into two groups, so to speak. So, I mean, there are some basic tests for colitis, Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, endoscopy, colonoscopy, maybe a capsule endoscopy or the smart pill, as it's also known. These can definitely give some very important information as it regards to the gold standard of diagnosing inflammatory bowel conditions or inflammatory bowel disease. For the most part, these are kind of like the gold standard diagnostic tools. However, there are some cases of inflammatory bowel disease that elude the more classical tests as we just discussed. And these fall under a umbrella known as microscopic colitis. And underneath the umbrella of microscopic colitis, there can be collagenous colitis or lymphocytic colitis. And these are where the inflammation may not be able to be seen via endoscopic examination, but when a biopsy is performed, we can see it there. There are also blood tests that can help with this that actually look at some of the autoimmune antibodies that are associated with inflammatory bowel disease. So looking at some of these markers like a blood test can help with filling in the gaps where perhaps a traditional colonoscopy, endoscopy have come up negative. I think what is a little bit more practical, a little bit more simple, and also yields a lot of benefit are some of our traditional inflammatory markers. So for inflammatory bowel disease. So what this looks like is elevated ESR, or erythrocyte sedimentation rate, or C-reactive protein, in conjunction with calprotectin and lactoferrin. And the real nice utility about or regarding calprotectin and lactoferrin is they tend to oscillate or correlate, rather, with severity of IBD. And what's really helpful, I think, about these markers is that they can elevate in a predictive fashion, predicting a relapse. So I think the main utility for maybe the people listening who, let's say they're on something like mesalamine and they are trying to work off of that and use a natural intervention in its place, they could be tracking maybe every month or every other month or so calprotectin, lactoferrin, C-reactive protein, ESR, and if the levels of those start to creep up and up and up, then that may tell you that you need to be more aggressive with your natural therapies, or if you've been trying to kind of open up and broaden your diet after being on a really restrictive diet, seeing these markers start to creep up can start to tell you, hey, I need to kind of tighten up the diet, be a little bit more strict. And so I think the real nice utility of those markers is that they can, again, predict a coming relapse. So those are some of the basics that can be practical and helpful for inflammatory bowel disease. There are some other inflammatory markers that are run, but they haven't been as well validated. So I think it's important for people to know that because there are other labs that report other markers like chymotrypsin, for example, and they just don't have the scientific validation. So if someone is wondering about other inflammatory markers, I would caution them to stick with these because these have been shown to have the most utility. And so if they work, there's not really a need to do copious amounts of other inflammatory marker testing, because what does it really tell you in terms of what would you do differently in terms of treatment? So I guess I'll pause there for a moment before going on to the other side, which is IBS.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to jump in, and I love what you said, and I also really love the idea of using it to gauge how your food reintroduction is going. I never thought of that, but that's absolutely brilliant. Those blood tests, again, are lactoferrin, calprotectin, and then serum reactive protein?
C-reactive protein and ESR, or what's also known as erythrocyte sedimentation rate.
Okay, you got to say that other one really slowly because I'm trying to write it down.
Sure. It's erythrocyte, which is the name of a red blood cell. Erythrocyte sedimentation rate.
ESR. Perfect. And then C-reactive protein, calprotectin, and lactoferrin.
Yep.
Excellent. Okay, so those are the ones for colitis. And would you use those for Crohn's as well?
Yep, they've been shown to correlate with both Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis.
Okay, and those can all be run off of one blood draw, correct?
Well, lactoferrin is typically fecal.
Okay.
And I like those best when someone has insurance coverage, because they can be a little bit pricey if they're run via a cash pay lab. But the good news is that if someone does have health insurance, and these are fairly conventional markers that someone should have very good coverage for. It's not like they're a highly fringe marker that insurance companies may resist more so with coverage.
Okay, perfect. All right, I'm going to ask you my next question, then I'll go back on mute. So for irritable bowel syndrome, which are the tests that you're finding to be the most effective?
With IBS, you know, I think there's an important qualifier to make regarding diet, because with many types of testing, the tests are not perfect, meaning this test is not 100% accurate or 100% consistent. So it's really good practice to not overly rely on testing. And this is actually, again, coming back to our earlier point, the more time I spend in clinical practice and the more chance I have to interface with other clinicians who I think are highly educated and highly respected, the more I start realizing that this thinking that tests are the end-all, be-all is really not something you see, I think, in these clinicians of highly educated, in these circles of highly educated clinicians. So what we want to try to do is position a patient in such a way that we've kind of weeded out any other confounding factors. And IBS is a really good example of this. Someone's diet can cause many, or they can worsen IBS symptoms. Now, there's also lab tests and things that we can test for that can also underline IBS. So this probably goes without saying for your audience, but we want to first try to get someone on the healthiest diet we can, or at least a reasonably healthy diet, and then reevaluate before we go into testing, because now we have more confidence based upon the testing, meaning we've isolated other confounding variables. And just to give people a quick purview on diet, there's a lot of information regarding diet, and I look at diets in a kind of simple fashion, meaning depending on the type of gut that someone has, and there's kind of three gut types that I look at, I think a different dietary approach is right for that person. Now, and then I'll come back to your question of IBS, but I just want to make sure to briefly touch on this. If someone has what I call an atrophied gut, that means their gut is generally healthy. There's no damage, there's no inflammation, there's no infections, there's no overgrowth. The gut's just a little bit atrophy. Atrophy meaning it just needs some exercise, right? So these are people that will do well on high-fiber diets, they'll go on lots of prebiotics, they'll go on maybe something like resistant starch, which is also a prebiotic. And people may have heard certain things coming out of circles on the internet that are very enthusiastic about this feed your gut bugs sort of camp. For people with an atrophied gut, this type of approach works very well. However, there's two other gut types. There's those that have imbalances and overgrowths, and there's also those that have inflammation or autoimmunity. This would be your IBD people. For both of these groups, the approach of feeding your gut bugs with fiber and with prebiotics has a very high probability of making them worse. So the atrophied gut can go on a higher fiber, higher prebiotic diet, but the second type, the imbalance and the overgrowths, will probably get worse from that. And the third type, the inflammatory slash autoimmune, will also probably get worse from that. So the people that have imbalances or overgrowths, like small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, which we'll talk about more in a second, they tend to do better on a lower fermentability diet. So these are things like a low FODMAP diet, SCD diet. These can be very helpful for this population because we don't want to feed their gut bugs, so to speak, because they already have too much. Then thirdly, we have the inflammatory slash autoimmune type of gut. These people also tend to do well on a diet like low FODMAP or SCD that does encourage bacterial growth. And further yet still, excuse me, they may do better on a low fiber diet or a diet that's low in insoluble fiber. And I'm sure many of your listeners are already aware of this, but lots of roughage, lots of plant fiber can be very irritating to someone that has a gut with inflammatory bowel disease. So I look at it like three gut types: atrophied, firstly, secondly, imbalanced or overgrowth, and then thirdly, inflammatory or autoimmune. And these different types of diets tend to work better or worse for these different groups. So once we've done some dietary tinkering and we evaluated if someone still has many of the symptoms of, in this case, coming back to your initial question, IBS, then there are lab tests that can be very helpful. And I think we can think of this in two general camps. We would want to do an evaluation for SIBO, or small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. And this is a breath test that essentially tells us if there is an overgrowth of bacteria in the small intestine. Now, the second test that can be done in conjunction with this, and we typically do this in conjunction, is to use a broad term, general parasitology. And so this could be a stool test, something like a biohealth test or a doctor's data profile, just to give a few examples of good labs. We will typically do two stool tests in tandem, looking for, again, general parasitology, looking for things like H. pylori, Blastocystis hominins, toxoplasmosis, candida, Yersinia, worms, amoebas, so things like this. Now, it's also possible to evaluate some of these things through more than just the stool, through blood, breath, and even a preliminary window through the urine. And so from a big picture view, I like to see one SIBO test and then two general parasitology tests. Oftentimes, the stool can be used, sometimes a combination of stool and blood and breath and even urine can be used. And I guess with that, do you want to go into detail about some of the specifics of these tests?
I think it would be really helpful if you gave specifics in terms of what someone listening can take to their doctor and have them test for.
Gotcha. Okay. So for the SIBO test specifically, it's a SIBO breath test that should be done over the course of 2, ideally 3 hours. And the way this test looks is someone does a breath sample roughly every 20 minutes for about 3 hours. Now, a solution is administered as part of this test. Lactulose can be used or glucose can be used. There's controversy over which substrate or which solution is best to be drank along with the test. I think we can really make a case either way, for either solution or for either substrate. It's important that the test does measure both hydrogen and methane gas. The reason why this is important is because this SIBO, or small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, can manifest as hydrogen gas or as methane gas or as both. So if someone, let's say, themselves has excessive methane gas, but their test only tests for hydrogen, they could completely miss the fact that they have SIBO, or small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. So in recap, a 2 to 3 hour test that uses either lactulose or glucose as a drink, and that will test for both hydrogen and methane gas. These tests typically are not very expensive. Usually they're around $200, and they can be done at home. There are some labs now that offer direct-to-consumer testing. Commonwealth Laboratories may. I believe Commonwealth Laboratories, you have to be through a physician. There's another company that we've been using that is a bit more consumer-friendly, and they're known as Aero Diagnostics. Now, the lactulose, you can't get on your own. You have to have a prescription for lactulose, so that's why you have to be working with a doctor in order to get the lactulose. But as I said a minute ago, there's controversy regarding what substrate is actually the best. And we're currently reviewing some of the literature on this, and we'll be recording a podcast in the future with Aero Diagnostics lab director, Gary Stapleton, and he's going to be giving his thoughts, and then I'm going to be, you know, covering what we found in our literature review and kind of talking through the pros and the cons. So if people really want to get into the details, they can, you know, stay abreast of what we have going on our website, and that will go out sometime in the next few months. So that's the SIBO breath testing. Now, regarding the stool testing, the stool testing is pretty straightforward. You can use a lab like BioHealth. They have a test called a 401H. Doctor's Data has a couple different tests. If we're looking just for parasitology, we run what's called their parasitology 3X. If we want to look at parasites plus some of the inflammatory markers like lactoferrin, like we talked about, then we'll order the comprehensive stool with parasitology 3X. And the distinction there is important because it depends on if we're maybe suspecting inflammatory bowel disease in someone. If we're not, I don't run that, and that saves maybe $150. And that small distinction, if someone has to be tested a few times, you know, really starts to add up. So I think a conservative model of testing is very important because a couple hundred dollars here, a couple hundred dollars there, over the course of treatment of a patient can manifest itself as a savings of a few thousand dollars. So, you know, again, I think a reason why it's good to be conservative in testing and not just test everything under the sun because it's interesting. Now, the other piece to this is if we wanted to try to do testing not with a at-home stool test, but with a insurance lab, like LabCorp or Quest in the United States, the insurance labs, I can speak for the United States, I can't speak for outside of the United States, but the insurance labs like LabCorp and Quest actually have very good testing in this regard. There's an erroneous assumption that you have to do one of these specialty kind of cash pay functional medicine labs to have a good parasitology evaluation. However, I've been testing that hypothesis for a couple of years now, and I run one of these home stool tests by a company like Doctor's Data or BioHealth, which I think are great companies. And I've run those in conjunction or side by side with one of these more classical insurance-based labs like LabCorp or Quest. And I've seen very equivalent results. Now, perhaps, if I may, where this may come from is the fact that much of functional medicine education is done through these specialty functional medicine labs. And so there can be biases, you know, inherent in there, just like much of conventional medicine may be a bit biased from pharmaceutical education. Same thing happens in functional medicine with lab testing and supplement companies. This is not a bad thing. It's just we want to make sure that we're not, you know, we're being given the best information. And so it's important for the consumer to be aware of this. It's not to say that a functional medicine lab company or supplement company has bad intentions, but like anything else, you have to make sure that, you know, you're not falling into a bias. So these conventional labs seem to work just as well. Why that can be important for a patient is really twofold. Since these conventional labs bill to insurance, we can save someone the cost of that second stool test. And a home stool test typically ranges around $300, maybe a little bit more or less, depending on the depth of what you're doing, but as a general rule, about $300. So if we can save someone $300, you know, it's $300 there and about $200 with the other test I was mentioning, and these things very quickly add up. Now, the other nice thing about these insurance labs being able to draw blood, for example, we can start to use other ways of assessing certain infections. So, for example, Candida, H. pylori, Yersinia, toxoplasmosis, and C-reactive protein and erythrocyte sedimentation rate, as we mentioned earlier, all of those are tested via the blood. So they can be helpful to have additional insight. Now, some of these things like H. pylori and Candida, some of the bacteria slash fungi slash infections or whatever you want to call them, they can be tested through the stool or through the blood. What I like to do is to test through both because this gives us multiple windows looking at the same factor, and sometimes we won't find something on one window, but we'll find it on another. So, you know, it's some of this gets a little bit complicated, and I think the challenging part for people listening is, you know, what do I tell my doctor if I want to try to run one of these panels through, like, LabCorp or Quest, one of the conventional insurance labs? I don't really think that's possible because your doctor has to know all the different markers that he wants to test, and you have to then fill out a lab requisition with all these markers. And there may be as much as 20 individual codes for when you're doing this through the insurance system. So it takes a little bit longer to learn all these codes and find all these things. That's maybe part of the reason why the at-home cash pay labs are more popular, because oftentimes this is just organized into a panel. For example, the BioHealth 401H, these things are just organized into a panel, and the provider only has to just check that box on the requisition form. However, if someone was, you know, had a doctor that really wanted to work with them and wanted to do a little bit of homework, you could just look at the markers that BioHealth is testing and convert all those markers into the LabCorp or Quest or insurance lab system and get all the appropriate coding and then go from there. So maybe a little bit of a hairy thing for some people, but hopefully that kind of helps them with some of the testing. Is there anything there that you wanted to expand on?
Well, what I would like to know is, first of all, if someone, okay, first question, do you take phone and Skype clients, or do people have to come and see you in person only?
That's a great question, and that's one of the really interesting things about medicine right now is that the acceptance of telemedicine is really growing. So, yes, our clinic does provide telemedicine services via phone or via Skype, and we are accepting new patients. And, again, what's really nice is major hospitals, major medical practice groups are really starting to open up into this telemedicine model to make it easier for patients and also help patients that are in remote locations have access to the care that they need. So, yes, that is something that is very doable for this kind of model.
And then, so if someone comes in as a teleclient, they can you still access their, you know, whatever tests they have that are covered by insurance? Is that all apply just the same as it would if they went to a local doctor?
That can vary slightly from state to state. There are some states that have rules against this. If a patient is international, then as far as I understand it, you can't, me being in the United States, I can't plug into the Canadian insurance system, at least as I understand it. But for patients that are in state, very, very good. For patients that are in the United States, it tends to be very good also. It's just every once in a while, there's a little bit of something that we have to double check on. But for the most part, these things tend to work pretty well.
And now let's say that somebody did want to see a doctor locally. What type of doctor would you recommend they search out?
This is a great question. So just a quick maybe side note is I'll be speaking this year at the Paleo FX conference in Austin, Texas, and I'll be doing a lecture entitled Demystifying Functional Medicine, kind of, you know, how to get started with functional medicine in an efficient and in a cost-effective manner. And we'll be talking a lot about this. And once I give that lecture, I'll probably, share many of those things through our newsletter and through our website, either via podcast, articles, or videos. So that lecture is not for a few months, so that information probably won't be going out for a few months. But if people, you know, wanted to get an expanded narrative on this, that would be coming down the pike from us. But in short, as an answer to your question, there's a couple important things. It's important for people to have, in my opinion, both a conventionally trained and practicing doctor and a more functional doctor. And the reason for that is because, you know, the training is different. And sometimes people make the mistake of thinking that if they're working with a functional doctor, they have all their bases covered, or if they're working with a conventional doctor, they have all their bases covered. And really what you want is you want someone who's good and specializes in each one. The conventional doctor will take you through a more conventional assessment and treatment options, and then you have the second opinion and the ability to compare and contrast with what the functional medicine doctor offers. So it's important to be aware of that. Now, what type of doctor or what to search for is a little bit less straightforward, because any type of doctor can practice functional medicine. And it doesn't really matter what kind of doctor they are. So they could be an MD, a DO, a DC, an ND. In my opinion, the training that they've had when it comes to determining if someone is highly skilled in functional medicine for gastrointestinal care, the training is less relevant, but what's more relevant is that they display a high level of training and focus on the gut. Oftentimes when people start practicing functional medicine, they can start practicing a very broad model, meaning they do some stuff with hormones, they do some stuff with the gut, they do some stuff with detoxification, and that's all fine and good, but if you really want to have a thorough evaluation, it's a good idea to work with someone that has displayed that they have a high level of focus on the gut. So look and see, have they done any writing, any videos, any interviews, and you're looking to see that they are displaying a high level of specialization in the gut. The other thing that one should look for are, you know, as you're looking into some of this gut stuff, you're probably going to hear a few things come up again and again and again. There'll probably be a few things with most of the articles that you read or videos that you watch that you've seen repeated a few times. I would ask the doctor that you're trying to evaluate about those things. They should at least be familiar with them. They may not recommend them, but they should at least be familiar with what you're talking about. The other is that it may be twofold. One, that the clinician is not an alarmist. They don't seem like they're trying to scare you. They don't try to almost use fear as a motivator and make these things sound very terminal. I mean, certainly sometimes they can be, but what I found, and this is my personal opinion, a practical conservative doctor is usually a really good way to go. People that are very elaborate and excessive, in my case, I found, you know, there can be a lot more waste. And the other thing along with that would be, again, my opinion, I think there could be an exception to any of these rules, and I'm certainly open to that. The other thing that I would mention is that to be on the lookout for extended period care plans. Sometimes, there may be a sign up for our gut care plan that is 6 months in duration and includes all your testing, all your treatment. I'm open to that. I certainly don't want to offend anyone who is doing that. I think there's an exception perhaps to this rule. But if you were my cousin or family member or friend, I would be a little bit cautious. If I were giving you this advice, I'd be a little bit cautious with that because in my experience, more often than not, those sorts of care plans are designed more so with a financial incentive rather than they are, and kind of treating everybody the same. Everyone gets this test. Everyone gets this treatment. It's a package deal. That just tends to not be a good indicator for a clinician who's trying to work with you, trying to be conservative and efficient in their care. So hopefully that will help people with trying to sort through all the different options they have for finding a doctor or a clinician.
Okay, that is just fantastic, and I really appreciate you being candid and giving such great detail on all of the points we talked about. I know you have to shoot off, so for everybody who wants to know more about what we've talked about, and also it's a really good idea to just connect with Dr. Michael Ruscio over on his site because he does have a lot of podcasts and current information, and he's very rigorous on testing and research. So he's a great touchstone for you to, check in with maybe what your doctor's saying or the stuff that you're reading yourself to make sure you're not getting diverted off into the latest fad or trend that actually doesn't have any basis in science or any kind of testing to see if it tests out over the long term. So Dr. Michael Ruscio's website again is drruscio.com, drruscio.com. Thank you so much, Michael.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
All right. We'll talk again soon, I'm sure.
All right. Great. Thank you. Bye-bye.